From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's 60s Music Week on Fresh Air, featuring interviews with hitmakers of the 60s, from the Brill Building songwriters to the British Invasion and the psychedelic bands. Today we hear from the lead singer of one of the greatest girl groups, Ronnie Spector of the Ronettes.
I want him.
The Ronettes' hits included Walking in the Rain and Be My Baby, which opens with one of the most famous drum lines in rock history. Later we'll hear from the drummer on Be My Baby, Hal Blaine. He played on many hits produced by Phil Spector and recordings by Leslie Gore, Elvis Presley, and the Beach Boys. Then we'll meet the genius of the Beach Boys, Brian Wilson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
And I'll be certain he's my guy.
First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush met today with Saudi Arabia's ambassador for talks that included the Bush administration's desire to oust Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. White House officials say the president also talked to Prince Bandar bin Sultan about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and increasing Saudi aid to Afghanistan. The Saudi royal family has said it opposes any American military action against Iraq. A top UN official in Afghanistan said today that the Afghan government is not able to launch an investigation into alleged war crimes by members of the U.S.-backed Northern Alliance. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports from Kabul.
Witnesses charged that troops loyal to Northern Alliance General Rashid Dostum herded as many as 1,000 Taliban prisoners into airless metal shipping containers last winter. Their bodies were tossed into a mass grave, and a preliminary examination by a UN forensic team showed that many of them suffocated. General Dostum is now part of the transitional government. And today, UN Special Representative Lakhdar Brahimi said Kabul cannot ensure the safety of witnesses and that no investigation has begun. Brahimi implied that for now, fragile stability will take precedence over justice.
It's not a question of forgetting about serious crimes, but politics is the art of the possible.
U.S. officials say they support the idea of a probe, despite the fact that U.S. Special Forces worked closely with Dostum when the alleged crimes took place. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Kabul.
U.S. Olympic officials have chosen New York and San Francisco as finalists to bid for the 2012 Summer Games. The U.S. Olympic Committee eliminated Houston and Washington, D.C., the two other cities vying to host the Olympics. The official U.S. candidate for the 2012 Games will be chosen at a USOC meeting in early November. The Congressional Budget Office predicts that the federal budget will post deficits for the next 3 years, then show a gradual return to small surpluses. The nonpartisan agency has just released its revised budget projections for the next decade. NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
The CBO said a steep decline in money coming into the federal government has caused a dramatic change in the budget outlook. Politicians of both sides immediately latched on to the numbers as proof that their counterparts' fiscal plans are misguided. Democrats blamed the plummet in revenue on President Bush's tax cut of last year. Republicans said spending on social programs is eating up the surpluses. But CBO analysts say it's the decline in the economy that did the worst damage to the budget projections. When people and companies make less money, less tax revenue flows into the federal government. The CBO says the economy is recovering and expects the budget to return to black in 2006. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks, the Dow lost 94 points today. This is NPR News. Authorities in Tennessee say it'll take until tomorrow to find out whether there are anthrax spores or other dangerous substances in a white powder that was sent to the offices of former Vice President Al Gore. A hazardous materials team was called to the Nashville office after the office manager opened a letter and the powder spilled out. A spokesman said Gore was out of the state but was informed and has spoken with the office workers. Authorities have investigated many cases of suspicious powder in the mail since the anthrax attacks last fall, but all have turned out to be hoaxes. The Commerce Department says July orders for durable goods jumped by far more than most economists had expected. Steve Beckner reports from Market News International.
Orders for durable goods, longer-lasting, higher-priced products, rose 8.7% last month, the biggest gain since last October and the third in 4 months. The increase, which followed a 4.5% June drop, shocked Wall Street, where the median forecast had been for a rise less than a fourth that size, and dashed hopes for lower interest rates. Much of the strength was due to big jumps in defense and civilian aircraft orders, but there were also gains in machinery, fabricated metals, computers, and electronic products. Excluding defense, orders still surged 7.3%. Excluding transportation, they were up 3.9%. Orders for non-defense capital goods, a proxy for business investment, rose 13.5%. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 94 points, or 1%, to close at 8,824 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 44 points, that's 3%, to close at 1,347. The S&P 500 lost 14. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from WorldSpace, offering NPR programming for Europe, Africa, and the Middle East on digital satellite radio. Information at npr.org/worldwide.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're devoting this week to pop and rock of the 60s, from the Brill-Building songwriters to the British Invasion and the psychedelic bands. My guest is Ronnie Spector. In the early 60s, she was the lead singer of the Ronettes. Alan Betrock, the author of the book The Girl Groups, described the Ronettes as the pinnacle of the girl group era, and he described their first hit, Be My Baby, as the perfect pop record. A few years after Be My Baby rose to the top of the charts, Ronnie married her record producer, Phil Spector. At his insistence, she retired from the music business. After they divorced in the early 70s, Ronnie Spector started to record and perform again. I spoke with her in 1987, after the publication of her memoir, Unfinished Business. How did you first hear this song? Did the songwriter sing it for you before you performed it the first time?
Well, the first time I heard it, you know, Phil and those were and Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry. We met in a little studio, and they started writing around me. And I guess I was 16 years old and very shy, and I liked Phil at the time, and he liked me. I think they wrote it all around that. You know, our little love affair at the beginning. I think it was all a part of that.
Do you remember the recording session?
Like it was yesterday.
What was it like?
It was incredible, because there I was in California recording, and I'd never left New York. I'd never been out of New York in my whole life. And there I am on a plane going to California by myself without the other two Ronettes just to do the lead part. And I remember being in the ladies' room at the New York airport just singing in the bathroom, Be My, because I don't read music or anything, and I don't play any instruments. So it was like you had to just learn it over and over. And that's how, and then Phil asked me to come to California and do it at Gold Star Studios. And that's where we recorded it, and I loved it. I love it till today. I still love it. I mean, it's just a record that I remember that day being in the studio. I remember what color dress I was wearing. I remember everything.
You formed the Ronettes with two of your cousins when you were all teenagers.
No, a sister and a cousin.
A sister and a cousin. Okay. Now, how did you learn to sing harmonies?
Actually, it was like a bunch of cousins. I had so many first cousins. It was like three other girls besides the two Ronettes, and it was a boy cousin singing lead, and it just sort of narrowed down to one. And I remember the three of us being on the rooftop, like learning routines, because we never had a choreographer or anything. We sort of did what the street dances and stuff, and we just made it three. And I remember being on the rooftop, you know, rehearsing and trying to get our routines together and stuff for the Brooklyn Fox. And what did you say? How did we get together? It was a family, and we had a sort of strict upbringing. So we couldn't go out, and we could look out in the street and watch other girls walk and everything, but we couldn't go out because our grandmother was very strict. So we stayed in the house, and that's how we all just started singing, because out of boredom and out of all the people in our neighborhood were, like, becoming stars, like Frankie Lyman and stuff. And when I met him, I was in love with him. I didn't even know him, and I was in love with him. I was in love with his voice.
What kind of neighborhood was it that you grew up in?
I grew up in Spanish Harlem, which was terrific because it was like every race, every color, every language. It was wonderful.
You know, speaking of every race, a friend of mine has always wondered what your ethnic background was, because he thought that you looked... Sometimes you looked white, sometimes you looked black, sometimes Hispanic, sometimes Italian, you know?
I know.
And he thought it made you especially mysterious and intriguing.
Well, what I really am, and this is the truth, my father's Irish, and my mother is black and Indian. And every time somebody says black and Indian, they say, oh, come on, they don't have Indian. My mother is really half Indian, and she has a high cheekbones. And so I do look like all of those races. I mean, my sister's married to Chinese. My cousin in the Ronettes is half Spanish. So our whole family was sort of mixed up, you know, racially.
Well, I guess that explains it.
Yeah. So it's like there's Chinese, Spanish, there's Irish, there's no Italian, no Jews. But you may as well say there's everybody. That's why I love growing up in Spanish Harlem, because there was a little Chinese guy I used to play with, Ben. Their family owned a laundry in the neighborhood. And we just didn't think about color and stuff till I got much, much older. I didn't even know about it.
You broke into the music business by being a dancer at the Peppermint Lounge, being a dancer on the Murray the K Show,
right,
singing backup vocals. Did you do things in those early days to help get yourself noticed? Did you either, like, dress in such a way as to call attention to yourself? Okay, what'd you do?
First of all, you have to have a gimmick in this business, we figured. And so we wore our hair extra high, you know, the beehives in the 60s. And we wore eyeliner, you know, like Chinese eyes almost. And we wore slits up the side of our dresses because we sang and danced. So we really looked different. And what was the question? I forget. I get so excited.
Oh, about things you did to call attention to yourself when you were trying to break in.
See, when we first, we decided to dress up, and we had a lot of aunts. My mother has like six sisters, and so that's seven of them dressing us, and they told us to put a cigarette in our mouth. And we stood outside the Peppermint Lounge, dressed just alike. And I was so glad, because at 14 I was smoking. They just didn't know it. And it was great because we stood online, and we had to look older, so we had to exaggerate everything because all of us were underage. So it was very hard, but we had our gimmick. And it was amazing because before we even had Be My Baby as a hit record, being at the Brooklyn Fox's Murray the K's Dancing Girls, we would come out for lunch and it was actual girls dressed like us and our hairstyles. It was knocking me out. I couldn't believe it.
You had some of the highest hair in the whole music business.
Well, that's what I said. You had to have a little attention. And we certainly brought attention with those high hairdos. I mean, we must have worn our hair at least 10 inches high.
Now, you know, it always made me think that you were really tough, really streetwise.
No.
Were you? No?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, when we heard about people being junkies or dope addicts, I would ask my mother, well, let me see one, because the way my family would talk about them, it was like it was a disease, because I was very young and I didn't know. And I was, like, afraid of them before I even met them because I didn't know what they looked like. So I wasn't a tough streetwise kid at all. But we just did all the dances, you know, and by living in Spanish Harlem, you learned all the dances anyway. I mean, you could just look out the window and people were on the corner singing and stuff. And it was just and I loved it. From the time I was 3 years old, when my whole family applauded me, I remember the song was Jumbalanico, Vispina, Philly Gumbo. Cause tonight I'm gonna meet my machete meal. Pick a spot filled with Guy and Miguel. Son of a gun, we're having fun on the bayou. And I think that's when I got my ho, 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 ho. And then my family just started applauding me, and I was like 3 years old. And I said, that's what I want to be the rest of my life. I want to perform.
Let's get to more of your recordings with the Ronettes. You first signed with a small label called Colpix Records.
And, that's right.
Those records never really became hits. How did you sign with Phil Spector, with whom you really recorded your best-known records?
Well, what we did, we were still with Colpix at the time when we met Phil. And he had my mother go down to Colpix Records and tell them that we didn't want any part of show business. We wanted to go back to school, and we just didn't want to sing anymore. And this was all Phil's plan, and my mother's and Phil's plan to get us on his label. So they released us, Colpix, and naturally we hadn't had any hits from them, so it wasn't like they were letting go these big stars. You know, we hadn't had any hit records, so it was perfect. And my mother went there one day, and she got them to release us because we were underage, and my mother said, they don't want to sing anymore. And about 6 months later, we had a number one record. So
fooled everybody.
Yeah. So that's how we got to be with Phil on Philly's Records. But that's not how we met him, you see. My sister and myself and my cousin got together one night, and we said, how are we going to meet this Phil Spector? We hear he's the best producer in the world. And my sister said, well, why don't we pretend we're dialing him. We knew the number to his office. And we would pretend it's the wrong number and just say we're backup singers and we'd love to come down and audition for him. And that's what we did. We called his office one day and we said, hi. We're calling for an audition. We're the Ronettes. And they said, well, you must have, her name was Joni, Phil's secretary. And she said, well, maybe, I don't know if Phil is auditioning, that I hold on. So we held on, and next thing we know, Phil was on the phone, and he said, I'd like to meet you girls the next night at Mirror Sound here in New York. And we couldn't believe it, and we did. And, yeah, we sat down at the piano at Mirror Sound, and Phil said, sing me some songs that you guys just, you know off the radio. And, of course, by my loving Frankie Lyman, I started singing Why Do Fools Fall in Love, ABCs of Love, and he immediately fell in love with my voice. And he said, that's the voice I've been looking for.
Once he started working with you, did he make suggestions to you and the Ronettes about changes he wanted to hear in either the harmonies or the lead vocals?
No, because first of all, the backgrounds weren't just my sister and my cousin. It was like we had about 10 people. There was Cher, there was Sonny, there was Darlene Love. I mean, we had so many background singers on our records at the time. The lead singer was the most important. And the wall of sound. In the background, he had like 10, 20, and he would make those, double those voices. So it was, I don't know, it was very complicated in the studio, but it was, watching him work was a miracle to me, watching Phil Spector work in the studio.
You both became lovers. Did that add a certain drama to your performances when you worked together?
It may have, but I guess because I was, performing so much before I met him, I just had that, I love performing, and I don't think he, by falling in love with him, made me any better as far as my singing. I just think he knew what materials to pick out for us, you know, song-wise, like Be My Baby, Walking in the Rain, and he was just a great producer.
Walking in the Rain, we've heard some of Be My Baby. Is Walking in the Rain one of your favorites of the records that you recorded?
Be My Baby is my number one. I love it forever. And Walking in the Rain, I love it too. Yes, I really do.
I love that too. Why don't we hear a few seconds of it, and then we'll talk some
more. Okay.
Okay, this is the Ronettes.
I want him, and I need him, and someday, someway, whoa, 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 I'll meet him. He'll be kind of shy, and real good looking too, and I'll be certain he's my guy by the things he'll like to do, like walk.
That sounds great. That's Ronnie Spector singing along with a record from the 1960s of Walking in the Rain.
I couldn't help it,
Terry. Oh, that's terrific. You know, I'm thinking that the Motown girl groups had charm school and professional choreographers,
yes,
chaperones, all of that. Did you ever want evening gowns? Did you ever want the kind of polish that the groups like the Supremes had?
No, we didn't. We were strictly rock and roll. And I remember my one of my sister's boyfriends at the time, he came over to our house while we were doing our rehearsals at my mom's house, you know. And he said, why don't you guys try to be more classy and act like the Supremes and, you know, stand there and with your aunt. I said, look, we're rock and roll. We got to move. We were singing songs like What I Say, La Bamba, you know, Turn On Your Love Lights. And we were really rock and roll. And rock and roll to me is not just standing there and having a choreographer. It's being real. It's rocking and rolling and not having being so choreographed. I can't have it now.
Ronnie Spector, recorded in 1987. Coming up, Hal Blaine, the drummer who played on Be My Baby and over 40 number one singles. This is Fresh Air.
There is a rose in Spanish Harlem.
We just heard from Ronnie Spector, who talked about singing lead on the girl group classic Be My Baby. We're going to hear that record again. This time, listen for the drumming, and in a moment we'll meet the drummer, Hal Blaine. When Phil Spector needed a drummer, he often called Hal Blaine. Those Spector hits are just part of the reason Blaine is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's also played on hits by Leslie Gore, The Beach Boys, Bobby V, Elvis Presley, Dean Martin, Roy Orbison, Johnny Rivers, Sonny and Cher, The Byrds, The Associations, The Mamas and the Papas, Petula Clark, Paul Revere and the Raiders, The Supremes, Bobby Darin, Nancy Sinatra, and Frank Sinatra. Blaine is featured on thousands of records and over 40 number one hits. In 1963 alone, he played on Then He Kissed Me, The Do Run Run, Another Saturday Night, Surf City, Surfer Girl, Surfin' USA, and Be My Baby. I spoke with Blaine last year and asked if the opening drum line on Be My Baby was his idea.
You know, that's a very difficult question to answer because Jack Nitzsche was a pretty prolific writer, but he wrote very, very thin in those days. You know, this was the beginnings of rock and roll. Somehow, with my experience, I keep thinking that I was an awfully good faker. And it could be that the lick went boom, 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 with a backbeat. Boom, 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 boom. And at one point, while we were rolling, I may have missed the second beat. So we went boom, 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 and it stuck. It became a hook, and of course, one of the most famous hooks in rock and roll. That also happened to me, just to get off the beaten track. It also happened to me with the Tijuana Brass when we did A Taste of Honey. The song, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and everybody comes in, da-da, ba-da-da. Well, unfortunately, nobody was coming in together. It was like a train wreck. So at one point, me and my comedic mind, they went ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and I looked at the band and I started slugging with my bass drum. Boom, 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 diddle 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 diddle. Everybody came in. And once again, that became a major hook for that song. It happened to be my first record of the year.
Why don't we hear that part you're talking about? Blaine, what are some of the other records that had the most memorable beats that you played?
Well, I remember doing a record with Tommy Rowe. The record was called Dizzy. That was another one where I played a kind of a hook drum sound. Boom, dink, digga 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 ding, dink, digga 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 digga. Over and over, I found that by doing, I learned very quickly in the early days of rock and roll, that there were certain hooks that people wanted to go with, guitar players or bass players. And I found that I could do that with drums, and it worked beautifully by repeating a particular, every four bars or every eight bars, repeating a particular lick. One of the great records that I did with Sam Cooke was Saturday Night, Another Saturday Night, it was called. And that was another one with that same drum lick every 8 or 16 bars, whatever it was. Dig-a-dig-dig-dig-dig-dig-dig-dig. And, you know, all these drum licks kind of became the standard for rock and roll. All the drummers that I've spoken with through the years have told me that they grew up listening to the records that I played on, and that's how they learned. And I grew up listening to Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich, and that's how I learned.
In fact, I bet you've been to countless restaurants where people have been playing your rhythms on the table.
That has happened, I guess, in the past. You know, sometimes I've actually, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I've actually turned around to someone and said, do me a favor and let me play the drums. In a nice way.
Right.
Where I would explain to them that they were trying to play their fingers along with whatever the music was playing coming out of the speakers in the restaurant. That actually has happened to me, which is kind of funny that you would hit on that.
Hal Blaine recorded last year. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show as our 60s Music Week continues. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Kissing in Manhattan, fiction about love-hungry urbanites by David Schickler, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Brian Wilson, the creative genius of the Beach Boys. Also, the Phil Spector Sessions. We continue our conversation with session drummer Hal Blaine.
Well, East Coast girls are hip, I really dig those styles they wear. And the Southern girls with the way they talk, they knock me out when I'm down there. The Midwest farmer's daughters really make you
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's 60s Music Week on Fresh Air, featuring interviews with people behind pop and rock hits of that decade. Let's get back to our interview with Hal Blaine, a session drummer who's featured on thousands of records and over 40 number one hits. He played on many Phil Spector sessions and hits by Leslie Gore, Bobby V, The Beach Boys, Elvis Presley, and Roy Orbison. Now, you did a lot of records with Phil Spector, including Be My Baby.
Yes.
What are some of the things he had you do that other session heads didn't? What was different about working with Phil Spector?
Well, first of all, every Phil Spector session was a party. Everyone on the session, all the guys and girls, were the first call people, the A, if you would, the A gang. Everyone wanted to work with Phil Spector because they knew that some kind of a hit record, I mean, it was the talk of the town. Phil Spector was the guy that everyone wanted to see how he worked. He had a big sign on the door that said closed session, and yet anyone who stuck their head in, he'd grab him and he'd shove him in the studio and he'd say, Hal, give him a tambourine or a shaker or some clavies, some noisemakers, let him play something.
The musicians who you used to play with on rock and roll sessions were known as the Wrecking Crew. Why were they called the Wrecking Crew?
In the late 50s, we started playing rock and roll, and a lot of people said it was a dirty word. They didn't want to hear that kind of music. They thought the musicians were just rank amateurs. They had no idea that we were all well-learned and studied musicians with degrees and so forth playing music. And the old-timers, the guys that we kind of replaced, used to say, these kids are going to wreck the business. And I just automatically started calling us the Wrecking Crew. And then I became a contractor very early on. And doing the hiring for the sessions that I was playing on. And I just started, you know, people would call me and they'd say, get your crew together. And I'd say, okay, the Wrecking Crew, here we go. And I'd make calls. Eventually I had a secretary who made all my calls and so forth. So the Wrecking Crew stuck.
What kind of, would you get, like, sheet music? What kind of, how clear was it to you what they wanted you to play, or how much improvising did you do?
The music that was handed us physically were usually chord sheets.
Mm-hmm.
Chord charts are just, they're just road maps, starting at, you know, at the top and going through to the end with certain stops in between. It's just like any other road map. The things with, generally, we were hired for our expertise as such. We could do anything we wanted to do, and if any of it was offensive in any way, we would be told, don't play this or don't play that, or, you know, I like this lick or I don't like that lick.
Did Spector hum for you or clap for you the kind of things that he wanted, the sound that he wanted?
Not for drums. Phil used to use me like a racehorse. He would have me sitting there while he rehearsed. He would keep me from rehearsing, and I'd be chomping at the bit I want to play. And finally, he would point to me. He used to be in the booth, and he'd run back and forth. They had a huge window, and he'd run back and forth like he was conducting a symphony, and he'd look at the strings and use certain, you know, symphonic movements or the way a conductor would do. And he knew certain times he would look at me and he would say, now. And I knew he was saying now, which meant go for it. And I guess I used to go nuts sometimes on those drums, because if you listen to some of the fade endings on just about all those records, we used to go into double times and all kinds of things that were not unheard of on records. And everybody would go wacko. And then there was a time when Phil threatened to put out a record or an album of all the fades that we did. And the fades, if for those who don't know what a fade is, it just means when you hear a record playing and it gets to the end and it gets softer and softer and softer and it's gone. That's called the fade. with Phil, it went on forever. And finally, when everyone had had enough, and I always kind of had that feeling I knew when it was, I would go into my quarter note triplets against whatever was being played.
Clap a quarter note triplet for us.
Well, in other words, it's over, and I go da 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 da. So everyone knew, here it is, this is it. And Phil would never stop the machine until I played those quarter note triplets. So they're on the end of every record.
Now you were the drummer on a lot of the Beach Boys records.
Just about all.
But I think it was Dennis who was actually the drummer with the band. I imagine at the time nobody knew that he wasn't the drummer on the records.
A lot of people did not know in the early days that Dennis did not play on those things. Sometimes Dennis would come in and overdub a tambourine or something. But Dennis happened to be a friend of mine, and we each had our yachts very close to each other. We were both motorcyclists. But Brian used to come into the Spectre sessions. He wanted to see what so many people wanted to see. They wanted to know what we used to refer to as sprinkling the fairy dust on this tape that made it a hit record, that Phil Spector seemed to everything he touched were hits. And obviously after about the second or third record that we did with Phil, you couldn't get in the studio, but everybody wanted to know who was this Phil Spector, what was he doing.
So you met Brian Wilson at Phil Spector sessions, because Brian Wilson wanted to see what Spector
was
up to.
Brian used to come in and see us. We were introduced at the time. I think at the time Brian might have mentioned the fact that, boy, I'd like to have you play for me sometime. And I said, sure, you know, I play for everybody. Was not a problem. I was also working with these other kids called Jan and Dean, major rock stars in those days. And in fact, the Beach Boys used to come in and sing on Jan and Dean's record sometimes. Jan and Dean would go over and sing on the Beach Boys record sometimes. A lot of people didn't know that.
So did Dennis feel bad that instead of you on the records?
I tell you, I've told the story before. Dennis loved the fact that while I was in the studio in the afternoon making $35, $40 for the afternoon, Dennis that night was making $35,000 or $40,000 on stage. I mean, they were making a lot of money. And he was thrilled that he could just be on his boat. He didn't have to be in the studio. He didn't have to rehearse.
Well, let me rephrase the question. Did you feel resentful then that he was making all this money on stage and you were making next to nothing in the studio?
Not at all, because I knew what it was leading to, because my phone started ringing off the hook from Phil Spector dates and Beach Boys dates.
Right.
All of a sudden, I was getting calls for Elvis Presley and Johnny Rivers, and Fifth Dimension came along, and Mamas and the Papas. I mean, everybody came out of the woodwork.
Is there a Beach Boys track that you particularly like your drumming on that we can play?
Well, you know, I'd have to think about that a little bit. There are certain songs that make you cry. Songs like God Only Knows, one of the beautiful songs. Good Vibrations, of course, was another sort of a trilogy of Brian put that song together. Sometimes we would do, you know, 5 minutes on a session, and he'd say thank you, and sometimes we would work for days putting that song together. He just used to use little bits and pieces of this, that, and the other. I remember that on one of the sessions, and I think it was part of the Good Vibrations, Brian wanted something different, a different sound with drums or percussion. We used to drink a lot of orange juice, and they came in little small bottles out of a vending machine. And I took three of those bottles, taped them together, cut the tops off to various sizes, almost like the tubes on a vibraphone, and there were three different sounds, and I used a mallet that would be used on a vibraphone, and I got this knocking sound. Three different knocking sounds. And I used it on that section where we were playing ba-da-da, doo-doo-doo, ba-da-da. Well, I was playing ba-da-da, ba-da-da, different tones.
I hear the sound of a gentle on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. Softly smile, I know she must be kind.
That's the Beach Boys. Our interview with drummer Hal Blaine was recorded last year. Coming up, the genius of the Beach Boys, Brian Wilson. This is Fresh Air. Brian Wilson is one of the geniuses of rock and roll, and he's come real close to being one of its casualties. He was the creative force of the Beach Boys as their songwriter, producer, and lead singer. He wrote surf songs, car songs, songs about girls, and heartfelt, melancholy ballads. In 1964, Brian Wilson had his first nervous breakdown and retired from performing, but continued to write, record, and produce. Some of his best work was still ahead of him, like the album Pet Sounds and the record Good Vibrations. But that was followed by a period where he did no work at all. For about 2 years, he didn't even leave the house. His weight ballooned to about 300 pounds. It was assumed that his overindulgence in drugs and the trauma of having been abused by his father as a child contributed to Wilson's failed mental health. He went into therapy and eventually returned to performing and recording on a more limited basis. I spoke with Brian Wilson in 1988, after he released his first solo album, Away from the Beach Boys. Let's start with the Beach Boys' 1963 recording, In My Room, written by Wilson.
There's a world where I can go and tell my secrets to.
That your early sound was influenced by the Four Freshmen.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people would have thought of the Four Freshmen as being a really square group in their harmonies. What did you really like about them?
What did I like?
Mm-hmm.
I liked the way they blended their voices, you know, the sound they made as they blended their voices. I thought they were great. I didn't see anything wrong with the Four Freshmen at all.
What else did you listen to when you were young?
I listened to Rosemary Clooney.
Uh-huh.
And the Four Freshmen, and just different people, you know.
How did you start singing in falsetto, and how did you figure out that you could have a falsetto voice?
Well, because I used to practice my the freshman with the high voice and the poor freshman. Uh-huh. And his name was Bob Flanagan. And I practice along with him. Whenever I'd hear freshman songs, I'd sing along with the high note, you know. And I got into a habit of singing high. And when the Beach Boys, came along, I just took that habit of mine, that habit, bad or good, just a habit of singing high, you know. So then I started saying, hey, I sound like a girl up here. So I got into it. I got into it, you know.
The first songs that you wrote
and
recorded were surf songs. Now, you'd never surfed yourself, right? What was the inspiration for writing surfing songs?
My inspiration for writing surfing songs goes back to my brother Dennis, who drowned, of course, in 1983, in December of 1983. He asked me if I would be interested in writing a song about surfing. And I said, sure, I'll try it. And I tried it. And about a month later, we were on the Los Angeles charts, on the Los Angeles charts with surfing, you know?
Did you have to pretend like you were a surfer when the Beach Boys first got started?
No, not at all. Mm-mm. We didn't play the role of surfers. We sang about surf and girls, but we did not, whatever.
I want to play one of your early surf records.
What song is that?
This is Catch a Wave.
Catch a Wave, oh
okay.
Yeah.
It's the production on this is just terrific. There's a harp, there's an organ, it's great touches on it. Just say a little bit about how you produced this record.
Catch a Wave?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Michael and I wanted to do something where we would display the high voice, the medium voice, and the bass voice. All in one record, you know, at different intervals, you know what I mean? Not all at once sometimes, but separate from each other, you know? And it starts out, don't be afraid to try the great. That's the bass part, right? And then, da, 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 was my voice. And then Mike, da, 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 and then he was in the middle, too. So he sang bass and middle, and I sang high.
What about the instrumentation?
The instrumentation was just two guitars, a piano, drums, and a harp, and stuff like that.
Okay. Let's hear it. Catch a wave.
Catch a wave and you're sitting on top of the world. Don't be afraid to try the greatest sport around.
Catch a wave. Catch a wave.
Those who don't just have to put it down.
You paddle out, turn around and raise, and baby, that's all there is to the coastline.
Catch a wave and you're sitting on top of the world.
Not just a bed, cause it's been going on so long.
Catch a wave, catch a wave.
When you were writing songs like Fun, Fun, Fun,
yeah.
Did you think of yourself as having a lot of fun?
Well, Mike came up with those words. But yes, I did think of myself as having fun, fun, fun. But he mostly, because he wrote those lyrics. He wrote that part of the lyrics.
We're listening back to a 1988 interview with Brian Wilson. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. It's 60s Music Week on Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1988 interview with Brian Wilson, the creative force of the Beach Boys. Now, you also wrote a lot of really melancholy songs.
Yes.
And on Pet Sounds, for instance, you have a wonderful song. I wasn't made for these times.
Oh, yeah.
And I was wondering if you were ever felt reluctant to expose that part of yourself to your listeners.
You mean the Pet Sounds?
Mm-hmm. Well, especially songs like that, those yeah. feeling out of place type songs.
Yeah, I did that because lyrically, I did feel kind of like, I felt like a little Bob Dylan. You know, Bob Dylan was a message man with lyrics too, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I kind of was a spokesman for the Beach Boys. I had turned into a legitimate artist in my own right. And it was a very new, kind of a newfound power for me, right? If you ever experienced a newfound power, a mental power, you say, well, wait a minute, man, I'm way smarter than I used to be. You know, and like some kind of an awareness or something, you know? That kind of thing goes on a lot in my life.
When you wrote I Just Wasn't Made for These Times,
yeah.
was that how you were feeling?
When I wrote that, it was like a thing of... I really was feeling that way. Yes, I was, because I felt that I was being rejected by some of my friends, you know.
For what? And
who knows? You know, I just felt a rejection from the public. I can't explain it, you know, anymore now. It was a very super personal thing. It was a personal thing that I cannot really go into because it's too deep, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, I want to play some of that song.
And this is
from your 1966 album, Pet yes. Sounds, which... is really one of the legendary albums
in the history of
rock and roll.
Yes.
Yeah. And do you want to say anything else about what you were feeling when you wrote this?
Sure. I felt I had prayer sessions with my brother Carl, and we both prayed for people's safety and well-being. And we made this album with the fact that love was going to be the predominant theme in the album, with, of course, artistic and entertaining kind of music going on at the same time. But the love came from the voices that we did. And we just got into a little trip where we were going to bring some spiritual love to the world, you know. And we really did. You know, we actually did because we wanted to in our souls, you know. We both felt the calling, you know. So why not pray for this album and nurture it along and pray and have prayer sessions, you know. So it was very religious. It was a religious experience, like taking, some people think that psychedelic drugs are a religious experience, you know. And that's how I felt about... of course, about Pet Sounds.
Okay, so from Pet Sounds, this is Brian Wilson's I Just Wasn't Made for These Times.
I keep looking for a place to fit in where I can speak my mind. And I've been trying hard to find the people that I won't leave behind. They say I got brains.
When you were recording the record that we just heard an excerpt of, Pet Sounds, I think that was during a period when you were doing a lot of drugs.
Yes, I was.
How did the drugs affect your music, both in the good ways and the bad ways that
well,
it
affected
you?
Well, the bad ways, there's no way drugs can influence music in a bad way. That's a misnomer, or it's not.
No way drugs can influence music in a bad way.
No, music. I don't understand unless you feel that somebody would make unless you call heavy metal a very negative statement. You know, a very obtrusive, unartistic, or let's say destructive kind of a music that would provoke those kind of feelings. You know, no, actually, it's a matter of learning from these drugs. You know, you can go on drugs and make music, yes, on drugs, you know, but you're much better to make music off of drugs because you can see the overall picture better. When you make music on drugs, you're too concerned with this line or that voice or this and that, you know, other than just being behind it all the way behind it and putting together music from a higher standpoint than drugs can take you.
So are you saying that you'd use drugs for inspiration, but when you actually recorded, you try to not be high?
No high in the studio, no.
Uh-huh, okay. How did the drugs have a bad effect on you?
Well, they expose me to my weaknesses, you know, to the things in my life that I'm weak on, you know. And it's painful to have to sit there and accept your limitations in life, you know what I mean? But it's okay. It's okay at the same time, you know. It's okay to go through those changes. Everybody goes through them. Everybody's going to always go through them, you know.
You went through a period of time where you barely left the house and didn't do much recording or producing at all. What did you do during that time? What was life
like
for you?
I took a lot of drugs. I kept taking more and more drugs to get away from the rattly-bang, nerve-wracking aspects of life, you know. I kept telling myself, turn it down, somebody, turn it down. You know, that's like a way of saying, hey, cool it, you know. It's like, turn it down, it's too loud, you know. And I went through some of that. And, you know, like everybody does. Everybody goes through that turn it down thing, you know, where they want it down lower, not quite so loud. Maybe down here, you know, a little lower.
Besides drugs and stuff, what gave you pleasure?
Well, what gave me pleasure? Well, when I heard a first Phil Spector record on the radio, I said, you know, Phil, that Phil knows exactly what to put out there. He knows the formula, the secret, you know, of rock and roll. And I used to look up to the guy. And then I said to myself, you know, you can't all your life walk around idolizing somebody. You got to do your own thing, you know?
Brian Wilson recorded in 1988. Our 60s Music Week continues tomorrow. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, Lauren Krenzel, and Megan Howell. Unfortunately, today's the last day I get to mention Megan Howell in our credits. She's leaving radio to go to graduate school. We'll miss her insights, her intelligence, her ability to dramatically reenact my interviews, and the pleasure of working with her every day. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Henry and Edith Everett, recognizing Teach for America, college graduates teaching in under-resourced public schools, 800-TFA-1230. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the British invasion. We hear from Ray Davies of the Kinks and Colin Blunstone of the Zombies. I'm Terry Gross. Join us as our 60s Music Week continues on Fresh Air. Yeah.